St. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 5, Panto te chairete, rejoice always, always rejoice. And the word he uses there is the same word which is used for grace, same root.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about his presentation at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
By grace you are saved by faith, and this not of yourselves. It is a gift of God. That's square one. And then Paul goes on to say, pray without ceasing and give thanks. Those all belong together. Rejoice, pray, and give thanks, all under the grace of Christ. The result is a deep joy.
You can meet and hear President Matt Harrison making the case for being joyfully Lutheran at the one and only 2019 Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here with leaders from across the country and all around the world who are all united by a shared belief in the glory of God and the power of prayer.
I believe that God is love, which is more accurate than saying that love is God. God is the epitome of love. He defines what love is.
No, not so, dear brother. I did not point you down that path so that baptism should grant the liberty to sin. Quite the opposite.
To stray from God's created order and God's created design then becomes a direct attack on the triune God of love in whose image we are made.
Southern Illinois bird watchers love Issues Etc.
One of the best things about the Issues Etc. Making the Case conferences is the opportunity to meet and hear these regular guests here on the program in person, to have a conversation with them, to ask those questions that you've always wanted to ask them. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Memorial Day. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. During the next hour, we're going to hear from all of the speakers at the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Houston, Texas. We allow conference attendees to ask questions of our speakers. Our first round of Q&A featured Rod Dreher of the American Conservative, Molly Hemingway of Fox News, and Washington, D.C. journalist Mark Hemingway. It began with a question I asked Mark about a joke that actor Alec Baldwin had made about a Mark Hemingway on the sitcom 30 Rock. I asked, are we certain that Baldwin was talking about this Mark Hemingway?
That seems to be the case. I should add that I was kind of the butt of a joke, although I guess that's a bit of a badge of honor. I don't really know what to make of it, except to say that, you know, my wife and I have done a lot of media appearances over the years, obviously, including some fairly big programs and cable news and other things like that. And none of those things come even close to having your name mentioned on a network sitcom that is watched by an average of like 16 million people. I was actually cleaning the toilet at the time that episode aired. And I just looked down and my phone like exploded. And it didn't stop ringing for...
Days.
For days. And there was a story the next morning in Politico about me. So... Yes.
What was the joke?
I can't remember. Great. So if you watch the show 30 Rock... There's a relationship with Alec Baldwin, plays this Jack Donaghy, the network boss, who's talking to Liz Lemon, who runs the show. And Liz is always very sort of flustered and zany or whatever. And she went on to say something that was just sort of, you know, awkward and nonsensical. And he looked at her and he said, Liz, that was beautiful. It was like Hemingway, Mark Hemingway. So I don't know whether liberal Alec Baldwin just read something of mine that he did not like, or simply that the writer's room like went, okay, who's the next most famous Hemingway?
Yeah.
Who's a writer? And my name popped up.
Yeah. I think I texted your wife. I was watching it live, I believe. And I said, I think I texted Molly and said, did they just mention Mark on 30 Rock? Because it was kind of like one of those moments where you think, okay, maybe I fell asleep momentarily. A question for Molly. I'm modifying an attendee's question here. What news networks do you trust, if any at all? And if so, why? If not, why not?
Well, that's an easy question to answer. I think, in general,
the major change we've seen in the current media environment from a previous media environment is that there aren't necessarily publications that you trust, but there are names that you can trust. And so I find that I will look to a reporter who has done a good job on a particular topic, and then I'll keep following him or her. But there's not necessarily, and they can be anywhere. They can be at the New York Times, although I wouldn't recommend the New York Times in general. Like Rukmini Callimachi is a great reporter on ISIS, and she is someone who you can kind of go to after there's an attack to get a little bit of information. She's at the New York Times. But if there were publications that I do highly regard, other than my own, The Federalist, I would say, I mean, I would say The Wall Street Journal is really the only newspaper that I, and I don't think by any means that every story they write is take it to the bank, but they're pretty good, got a great editorial page. And I would also say, in general, reading your news as opposed to watching your news is good.
That's good advice. Very good advice. A question for Rod from one of our attendees here. And again, I summarize for the sake of time. One of the big differences between the Benedict option as exercised by Benedict himself and the Benedict option that you suggest for us today is we live in a world that technologically permits basically the globe to be made as big as a phone in your hand. What difference does that make for Christians as they think about the Benedict option in a world where technology allows us instant communication, the illusion of instant knowledge of what's going on around us, and an instant access to that public square?
A lot of people think that technology is neutral. It's not neutral. It can frame the way that we perceive the world. And I think the internet and social media are a perfect example of that. And I'm guilty of this too. You know, I was telling somebody earlier today at the conference that I moved into a house this summer in Baton Rouge, a new house, and I work at home. And yet most of my friendships occur online. They're with long letters that I've been with people I've been writing to for years. Some of them I've never even met, but I don't know who my neighbors are. And that's on me. But I think that if you ask me, do you have good friends? Well, yeah, well, I don't, but they're not actually in the flesh. So I realize I can't live that way. It's not to say my friends who live in D.C. or New York or wherever they live are not good people and not valued friends, but this disembodied sense that you get from living online is something that is, I think we have to fight against. And so in terms of the Benedict option, one of the things that we've done as parents, my wife and me, as we think of our home as sort of a domestic monastery in a number of ways, but one way in particular is not to let media and technology run our family's life. Our kids don't have smartphones. The one who's 18, he does, but he got his much later. And we don't feel that we can completely separate them from technology completely, but we feel like we need to protect them as long as we can to help them build an internal resilience and to know how to use it responsibly. We don't have a cable TV in the house. Our TV is hooked up to Amazon streaming and Netflix. We curate what our kids watch, and we watch it with them usually. Those are small things, but they turn out to be huge. Whenever I go to Christian colleges, I'm always asking about the question about technology. To a man and to a woman, the professors always say that the technology, the smartphone has ruined these kids, their capacity to focus and to imagine. And also there's a whole pornography question. This is enormous. And so I think one thing that Benedict would do today is say, disengage so much from internet technology so you can keep your head in the real world.
Excellent. This one's for Molly. Again, we're sticking with Molly and Mark and Rod for the sake of time. Do you believe that the factual errors in news reports, especially those regarding Christianity, but in general as well, are intentional or are they due to ignorance?
I do believe that the errors that you see in regard to religion reporting are due to arrogance and bias that the bias plays a role in the errors. It causes people not to want to get the news correctly or to think about how they're going to shape things. But also, I feel like there's been a big change in how people are responding to error. Michael Crichton wrote this great essay on skepticism many years ago where he talked about something called the Gell-Mann amnesia effect. And it's about how when you read a newspaper story about something that you know about and it's in error, you just look at it and you think, how could they have gotten this so wrong? There are factual errors. The underlying assumptions are incorrect. The people they went to for quotes weren't the right people to opine on this topic. And you're just disgusted. And then you turn the page and you read the story about the Palestinian conflict as if it's the word of God. You have amnesia about the problems with news reporting. But what I think might have happened recently, and you see this reflected in so many opinion polls, is that people no longer have amnesia. I think there's just been a cratering of trust in the media that is even more problematic than an over-reliance on media or too much trust. And people are just questioning everything, no matter how well-sourced a story may seem. And again, this is due to some major problems that the media brought on themselves. Like, for instance, there was a big story that Rolling Stone ran, the cover story about a gang rape at University of Virginia that turned out to just be completely fraudulent. But it was well-reported, well-sourced. Everybody praised it as this journalistic feat and turned out to just be anything but that. And you have enough stories like that come down the pike and you just start not believing other stories.
We're listening to the speaker Q&A from the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Houston, Texas. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. When we come back, a question about persecution of those who refuse to use government-mandated pronouns. Stay tuned.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Discover a truly Lutheran approach to education. Concordia University Chicago's Center for the Advancement of Lutheran Liberal Arts supports a vibrant, growing community of classical educators. Whether you're a teacher, administrator, parent, or homeschooler, we have the resources and contacts you need to start a child's journey into the Lutheran Liberal Arts. Visit cuchicago.edu/cala. That's C-A-L-L-A.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship. lcms.org/stewardship. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're listening to our speaker Q&A from the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Houston, Texas. Next up, a question for Mark Hemingway regarding Jordan Peterson, who has famously refused to use government-mandated gender pronouns. He says if he was fined, he would go to jail. If he would go to jail, he'd go on a hunger strike. The question is, from the listener, if they're going to persecute us anyway, why not go all the way? It seems more effective to take that route than extended legal battles. Here's Mark's response.
Right. Well, this is a good question. I mean, the pronoun issue could be a stand-in for any number of matters of important conscience. And like I said, you know, it's not an issue of whether or not you're just going to engage in willful disobedience, you know, right away. I mean, we might already be reaching a situation here, like I mentioned, this Jack Phillips case, the Baker in Colorado, coming before the Supreme Court. I mean, that's going to be decided sometime, you know, near the spring, early summer of next year, whenever the Supreme Court hands down its decision. And if that comes down, you might already be in a situation where I think that a lot of Christians would come to, I think, possibly a reasonable conclusion that some kind of, you know, passive, you know, nonviolent resistance might even be necessary to, you know, prove a point, you know, and properly stage a political protest and make people aware of the situation. But I mean, I do think that the transgender stuff is a good example in the particular sense that I forget what friend of ours who's a writer sort of coined the phrase, but they call it violence of the mind, which is to say that they're trying to train you that objective reality is not, you know, reality. And at some point, I mean, you really have to draw the line. You have to protect your own literal sanity, you know, and you cannot tolerate, you know, things like that. You cannot be forced to call a man a woman and vice versa. I mean, it is as plain a fact, you know, as this table is solid. You know, you don't get to let the government come in and start, you know, dictating objective reality. I mean, that is the kind of thing that you see in an authoritarian, you know, the worst authoritarian regimes that, you know, in human history. You know, the only they have dared to try this stuff, and it always ended up in bloodshed.
I just want to say, if they can make you say Bruce Jenner is a woman, they can make you say anything. Mm. Yep. And that's, at the end of the day, that's the point. The feelings of the transgender person, that's a sideshow, right? That's the cover. The issue is power.
Yeah, that was the point I tried to make in my presentation last night on religious liberty. I mean, it is ultimately about exercising political control. It has very little to do about bigotry because there are all kinds of, you know, ridiculous double standards here that apply. I mean, for instance, we're talking about this Senate candidate that in Alabama today, you know, who's been accused of improper relations with minors. Well, you know, I have all these liberals, you know, screaming that it is impossible for a 14-year-old to consent to a sexual relationship that also believe that a 5-year-old can determine their gender. You know, which is it? You know, at what point do you draw the line and say you people are establishing a totally, you know, a total double standard that is in defiance of common sense and reality, and you have to stand up and protect that. And I also tried to make the point that part of the reason why these things happen and these things become so egregious is that these things, we make these small abdications along the way, so we get to a point where all of a sudden we're confronted with these, you know, choices about defining reality as we know it. And we're really at a point where people need to stand up and say, no, enough. There's literally nothing that you can do to make me change pronouns.
Rod.
Yeah, I this is such an important point. In my book, I write about an example from history, from recent history, that we Christians should pay attention to. And this is the experience of the dissidents under communism in Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel in his circle. Havel was not a believer, but he was a good and righteous man. He wrote an essay called The Power of the Powerless, in which he talked about the hypothetical example of the greengrocer, who just puts up in the window of his shop, "Workers of the world unite," so he can go along to get along. But what if one day he decides he's not going to stand for that lie, he's not going to put the lie up there, and he doesn't put the sign up? He's going to suffer. He's going to suffer maybe his loss of his business, his kids aren't going to go to college, he'll never be able to travel abroad, and all the things the communist government and the communist order could do to punish him. But he will have won a victory because he will have demonstrated to everybody who can see that it's possible to live by the truth. It's possible, if you're willing to suffer for it, to not give in, to not capitulate. And in time, that man, that woman, those, that greengrocer and all the people who do this, they might make a revolution. But and Havel, again, not a Christian, but he said, we need to do that. Men and women of goodwill need to do that. Just don't go along with the system, but be prepared to suffer for it.
This one is for Molly. Christians used to understand better the importance of telling stories. National Public Radio almost completely takes this art form over with scads of programs like Moth, This American Life. Is there a way to tell our stories again? That's an excellent question, by the way.
That is such a good question that I don't know if I have a good answer to, other than
people who are good at telling stories should go into storytelling lines of work. And this is something that should be seen as a way to serve God by serving your fellow man, whether that's in artistry, poetry, storytelling, story writing, or journalistic storytelling. My husband's a very good storyteller, so I like to read his stories. It is important to think about all the different ways that people learn and receive communication and to serve their needs. But I don't really have a good answer other than Christians need to do it.
I would like to add that I think you really need to think of it in terms of vocation, which is to say that you serve God by fulfilling your vocation. So I see a lot of, people that view their art through the prism of, well, it's just, I don't know quite how to say this. They see it through a prism of Christianity before all other things.
Or politics.
Or politics or something like that. And that renders the sort of effectiveness of the artistic message, which is not to say that there shouldn't be a primacy to being a Christian and your motivation for it. It's just that, things can be really ham-handed when they come off as overtly Christian. I mean, what's the joke? What's the old joke about Christian rock? You're not making the church any better. You're making rock and roll worse.
Right.
I think that's it's a joke, but I mean I think it sort of gets the point across here. This is something that has been talked about a lot. Adam Bellow, he's a publisher, literary executive up in New York. He's better known as Saul Bellow's kid, I guess, who's also a conservative, wrote a great cover story for National Review a few years back, basically pleading and begging with conservatives, and I think this applies to Christians too, and faithful Jews and whoever else, to get into the arena of public debate in the arts, and to approach it exactly this way in this kind of vocational manner as Lutherans would understand it, because that's where you have influence on the culture. And again, I made the point last night with religious liberty. We can win all the legal battles in the world. If we lose the culture on these issues, it's over regardless. And that's where, these kinds of messages become really, really important.
Well, and if I could very quickly jump in here, I was recently out in California having lunch with a very well-known actress. She's a Christian. She's at the top of her field, been very successful. She told me, one of the worst things about being a Christian in Hollywood is there's so many bad artists out here who are Christians who come out here to make a difference for Christ, to tell stories in filmmaking and be an actor for Jesus. And they're terrible actors, and they're not good writers. They're not good directors. She said exactly what you said. Learn your craft first. You don't serve the Lord by being a third-rate actor. You serve the Lord by becoming the best you can at your craft and using that work to glorify Him. But that's why Christians are such a joke in the movie industry, because we make third-rate stuff, and we have bad taste. It's just true.
I don't know about we, but
well,
yes.
Yeah. In general, my face is impeccable, but the point is, too, the church needs to support its artists. The liberal secularists, they support their artists. They encourage vocations to the arts and to the humanities. We've got to do the same thing, too, because to paraphrase Shelley, artists are the unacknowledged legislators of the world.
We're listening to the speaker Q&A from the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Houston, Texas. Up next, a question for Molly Hemingway on whether she got any kind of reaction when she appeared on Fox News on Ash Wednesday wearing Ash Wednesday ashes. Are you looking for a First Communion, Confirmation, or Graduation gift? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is the new bonded leather cover edition of Luther's Small and Large Catechisms. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 and request the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Martin Luther's Small and Large Catechisms, 1-800-325-3040.
Trinity Lutheran Church, LCMS, of Tryon, North Carolina, also serves the South Carolina Upstate. We uphold the confessional standard of the Evangelical Lutheran Church. We follow the apostolic practice of celebrating the Lord's Supper each Lord's Day using a biblical historic liturgy. Our small parish is teeming with little ones, along with many of retirement age. Several Issues Etc. listeners have been welcomed into Christ's fold here from outside Lutheranism. We invite any unchurched in the area to join us at 10:15 each Sunday.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're hearing from the speakers from the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Houston, Texas. Most of them addressed the issues of Christianity and culture. You know, the handbook for the Christian as he makes his way in the public square and in the culture is Luther's Small Catechism. Along with Luther's Large Catechism, it is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May. They're bound together by Concordia Publishing House into one volume. Your handbook for living in the naked public square as a faithful Christian. Find out more about this resource at our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find it on every page. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Order the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Martin Luther's Small and Large Catechisms, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Up next, a conference participant asks Molly Hemingway of Fox News about whether or not there was any blowback after she appeared on Fox News on Ash Wednesday wearing ashes.
No, I wasn't sure if... I knew I was going to be on Ash Wednesday, and I was wondering if when I arrived, they would pressure me to remove the ashes. And far from it, I showed up. They said, "You're keeping those on?" I said, "Yep." They said, "No problem." And they all made a joke. Pastor Eckhart, our assistant pastor, had made... Have you ever seen that joke meme where it talks about the different styles of ashes?
Oh,
one's
yes.
called like first in line.
Yeah.
And one's called like one's called like angry father. And yeah. And people, I got some jokes because it was so big. And everyone else had these really delicate ashes. Mine was just like this. And some people sent me a joke. Looks like a combo of first in line and angry father. And I was like, yeah. But everyone was totally respectful. And Brett Baer even mentioned that I was wearing ashes because it was Ash Wednesday, because they assumed people would be very confused. And he said she did the right thing by going to church or something like that. And then I got emails from everybody, and I even got an invitation from the Vatican to come appear since I'd been such a faithful Roman Catholic. On
I told you you'd be a good Catholic.
So I had a lot of joy writing back, like, "I'm happy to come, but just so you know."
but
okay, we're going to wrap it up with our three, and I want to do a quick question from me for Mark and Molly, and this will act as kind of a combo. You'll both be able to answer it, but since you share children...
Sometimes.
You don't share Rod's children, I'll ask it for both.
Well, on the contract theory, maybe we will one day. We'll...
For the Hemingways, and we'll start with Molly, ladies first, what are you doing considering the fact that your children and your grandchildren are going to grow up in this world, and there's not a darn thing we can do about it, short of Christ's return to draw the curtain or close the curtain, as the case may be, what are you doing, what's your biggest concern, what are you doing about it with your girls?
Okay, so one of the things that I found so interesting about the pushback against Rod's wonderful book, The Benedict Option, is that when I read it, I thought, this is how I was raised. And I am so thankful to have been raised this way, which is that we were in the world, but we had these very strong institutions that helped us feel comfortable as Lutherans growing up. And that included parochial schools, a very tight-knit church community with lots of support from people in the church, regular reading of scripture and devotions. And more than anything, every time we talked to our parents, they just answered as Christians, and they would think about, they'd say, here's what God has to say about that. And also, of course, we were also watching television. I mean, we weren't sheltered from the world, but we were, like when we'd watch a movie, my parents would guide us as we were watching. They would say, now, does God want you to do that? You know, so if I'm watching a movie in a theater, I still hear my mother's voice like, no, should they be doing that? And I love it. So we try and do that with our children. They're in a wonderful classical Lutheran school. This is probably the most important thing we're doing on a day-to-day basis. We are very active in our church. They are very involved. They're very involved in the church community. And I don't really think that things are that... I think things are bad, but I think things have been bad a lot. And in a way, I think Christians are growing more aware of how bad they are than they were decades ago when they were really, truly getting bad and everyone thought they were not bad. So I'm not so worried about that. Mostly what I'm worried about is that should they be wanting to form a family, that there will not be men who have been raised properly to be good husbands, but I don't have any boy children, and I don't know what I can do about that other than pray. So that's all on you guys. So just do a good job with that.
What's your perspective on the father's side of it?
So, well, aside from what she said, I don't have a good, in terms of my own upbringing, I don't have a good religious perspective on this. Except in a very sort of narrow way, which is to say that I've told some of you this, and maybe some of you already know this, but I was raised in the Mormon church. And being one of the few positive things about being raised Mormon, well, there's a lot of positive things. I mean, the theology is a bit of a goat rodeo, notwithstanding. one of the very positive things about it is I very much grew up with a sense of being a total outsider. If you're a Mormon, you walk into a room and people openly disparage your religion in front of you, assuming that, like, you know, 99% of the population, you're not Mormon. And so I always grew up with this sense that I was an outsider and people weren't going to respect my beliefs, or my family, and I would have to sort of protect myself. And the other part of this is that I come from a heavily military family. My dad is a, retired Marine colonel, and my dad's dad was in the Marines for 28 years. My dad's uncle was a retired Marine general. My dad's brother was a retired Marine colonel. My dad was 5 years old and living in base housing in Pearl Harbor when it was bombed. My dad went on to go to the Naval Academy and was a Vietnam vet. And my dad's attitude through any sort of hardship was, basically... a little bit of, thinking on your feet, a little bit of hard work and not panicking can get you through most anything, including mortal danger. And I very much inherited this attitude, which simultaneously my wife loves and is extremely annoyed by. You know, things are falling down all around you and I'm sort of nonplussed about it. But I do think that it is important to inculcate that sense in your children. And I was thinking about this a lot recently because our church had a special screening at a local movie theater for the new Martin Luther documentary that I think PBS did. And I had this, thought about it. I mean, it really is true that no matter what you think about the oppressive forces of the world coming down, the fact of the matter is that the right man and the right circumstances can completely change the course of human history in ways that, you know, still sending shockwaves half a millennium later. So I think you need to prepare your children to have that sort of, you know, attitude. You know, maybe they're not all going to change the world, or, but, you know, preparing them for the possibility that they may have to do that, and they're going to have to rely on no one but themselves to protect their values and their faith and their family is, I think, crucial. And I think that used to be kind of a strongly and uniquely American characteristic more broadly that we're losing. And part of the reason why we're losing it is because Americans are also losing their religious identity.
Rod, for your family, talk about that. You have a family history going back with your parents and things like that, you've been very open about. But talk about, with your family, what it means to face the future when you won't be around to do what Dad does.
Right. Well, I endorse everything that Mark and Molly have said. We try to do the very same things in our family. I have the same worries for my daughter and my sons. But you can't control everything. You can't do it. There's never been a utopia for families to raise kids in. There were problems when I was a kid. There were problems my parents were raised with. But I think that the broadest thing we're trying to do is not so much to teach them what Christians think, though that's part of it. We're teaching them how to think as Christians do. You know, I think there's a real difference there, because we're not going to be able to give them the answers for every dilemma. But if we teach them what it means to think as a Christian by living it out, not simply sitting down and going over it like it's a school lesson, but by living it out, teaching them by example, because the social science shows us that parents are by far and away the most influential forces on their kids in terms of holding on to the religious faith. And I also think that I heard something very wise from an Orthodox Jewish rabbi. This is in my book. He said, you have to raise your kids like we do. You have to raise them with a consciousness that they are just links in a long chain going way back, and that will stretch out into the future. They're not autonomous individuals who just happen to be here and can make it up as they go along. They are defined by the story they relate to. In our case, it's the Bible, and including the New Testament, of course, and the Gospel, but it's also a much deeper and broader story. It's a story of men and women of the West. And that sounds very highfalutin that way, but our kids are getting that in their school, their classical Christian school, and we're trying to tell them that too by showing them art and taking them places to learn about their own history, to know that they are somebody from somewhere, and they have to receive this culture as a gift and steward it so it can be passed along.
When we return, the second round of our speaker questions from the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. Questions for Dr. Scott Murray, Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse, and Pastor Brian Wolfmiller.
Oh no! Another Lutheran dirge and other myths.
Pastor Will Whedon, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about this year's hymn sing at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
We'll be doing some myth busting during our hymn sing. Double dare anyone to participate and walk away thinking Lutherans sing dirges. From God's Own Child to Lord Thee I Love. From Dear Christians One and All Rejoice to In Thee Is Gladness. Oh yeah. Lots of joy bursting out in song all over the place. And so sorry, not a dirge in sight. Real Lutheran church music.
Join Pastor Will Whedon and Issues Etc. listeners from around the world for a hymn sing at our one and only Making the Case conference in 2019. Making the Case is Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th on the campus of Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more about the premier conference for Christian laity at issuesetc.org.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Emmanuel Press is a Lutheran-owned business in Fort Wayne, Indiana, in operation since 2004. That's 15 years of publishing liturgical and devotional books, 15 years of collaborating with Lutheran authors, artists, and translators. Thanks to our loyal customers and Issues Etc., we look forward to many more years of confessing and teaching the Christian faith. Visit us online at emmanuelpress.us. MMMANUEL Press.us.
I believe in the Holy Spirit. Christians confess these words each week during the Divine Service. But have you ever wondered, who is the Holy Spirit? Join Curtis Giese, Jeffrey Oswald, Charles Gieschen, and others in the May issue of the Lutheran Witness as they consider the person and work of the Holy Spirit. Special highlights include a Bible study by Matt Richard and an original Pentecost hymn text by Mark Preuss. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's time for round two of the questions from the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Houston, Texas. The panelists change to Dr. Scott Murray, Second Vice President of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse of the Ruth Institute, and Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, author of Has American Christianity Failed? The first question goes to Dr. Morse. The question is, why do children need their own parents?
Okay, why do kids need their own parents? I'm often asked this question, and then sometimes it'll have a little sneer on the end, like you've forgotten about adoption. But I would never forget about adoption because I'm an adoptive parent. And actually, that's how I know kids need their own parents, right? Because we're good parents to our boy, but we know the best thing for him would have been if none of this had ever happened to him, yeah. And he could have stayed with his own mom and dad, you know? I mean, we love him. He's part of our family. There's no question about any of that. You know, we were good parents. We're still good parents. But the best thing for him would have been if his mom and dad in Romania could have taken care of him and he never came to America and all the rest of it, okay? So that's the first thing that I would say. And I think a lot of adoptive parents know exactly what I'm talking about, right? Because you're part of what you do as an adoptive parent is to help them deal with the loss that they experienced, whether sometimes they experience it even when they're brought home from the hospital by their adoptive parents. Sometimes you see a kind of loss, a kind of wound, or whether they were kids like my boy who experienced some very profound neglect. Our life as adoptive parents is to help them deal with those losses, and you're never going to get there if you deny the fact that that was significant in the first place. So that'd be my first round of response to that. And then there are other things that one can say about it. I mean, we know that there's a bond that's created between mother and child in utero. There's evidence about hearing the dad's voice and the baby recognizing the daddy's voice. And, you know, just a lot of different things that go into it. And, you know, it's basically common sense as well that we need our own parents and that the God created us in this way, that we're brought into existence through an act of love. And that's God's plan for humanity, that every new person is brought into being through an act of love. And that's why our love for one another is so important as parents.
Dr. Murray, question from one of our...
Can I chime in on that one, though?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. The paradigmatic case is, after you have a child and it's time to go home, and you go to the nursery, and they say to you, pick out one of these, just whichever one you want, and take whichever one you want home. Is that ever going to be acceptable to a mother or a father? Absolutely not. Right? Why? Because there is an indissoluble bond in that birth between that child and his or her parents. And so the idea that just anybody can take care of the child doesn't even work, you know, from the very moment of birth.
Dr. Murray, you had addressed a lot of things last night, and due to the constraints of time, we asked you to skip two quarters of your paper. By the way, his paper will be available. He's going to make it available to us, and we'll probably have him on the program, talk about some of the things that we weren't able to talk about, and then make the paper available just on a link. You could just download it and read it for yourself. It's an excellent presentation. One of the attendees asks, has divorce and divorce and remarriage harmed the case for Christian marriage?
Yes and no. Next question.
Oh, come on.
That was a quintessentially LCMS bureaucrat.
Yeah, thank you.
You didn't pay him for it, though. That would have been...
Wait, where's my check? It's in here someplace. Yeah, I am a synodocrat. Yes, in the sense that in terms of practice, the church, I believe, has been far too, and I don't want to use the word tolerant, but dismissive of the damage that divorce does to children. And the result then is, and I actually see this, like, for example, in, and I had a couple come to me to get married. This is 20 years ago, maybe a little bit less. Both from families where there was divorce. And so we're talking about marriage, divorce, its meaning in premarital counseling. And finally, the young woman just looks at me and says, Pastor, you have to understand. We came here to Memorial Lutheran Church to get married because we do not want to repeat the mistakes made by our parents. We want our children to have united family where husband and wife stay together till death us do part. So I think children like this, I mean, these grown, I don't want to use the word victims, survivors of divorce, know what's right because they've suffered in their own lives and they don't want their own children to suffer. So that's why I say the answer is yes or no. We've seen the damage done, and again, I think the church has been sort of careless about that damage. And yet on the other hand, people are now, and this is what I'm seeing, especially in this parish, is a willingness to be repentant and to say, I don't want the same things happening in my family.
Pastor Wolfmiller.
Why are you smirking like that?
I like asking Brian questions for which he's totally unprepared. Please expound on how the Small Catechism and the Lutheran Confessions can be a framework for a quote-unquote Lutheran Benedict option.
Oh, that's the best. We know that when Luther, I mean, famously, Luther was critical of monasticism. I mean, you can, when you read Luther, I was reading Luther's sermons last year, just every week I'd read a house postal, and basically his sermon outlines are like this: law, gospel, here's the problem with the monks. I mean, that's how he preaches, right? And his criticism is profound. So that Luther will say that the vow of chastity is in fact breaking the sixth commandment, and the vow of poverty is breaking the seventh commandment. You shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal. The vow of obedience, so that's a threefold vow, the vow of obedience is breaking the fourth commandment, honor your father and mother, because it sets up an institution that God has not set up. Now, how can the vow of chastity be against the sixth commandment? Luther understood that when the Lord said, you shall not commit adultery, he was protecting the institution of marriage in the family. And when you took the vow of chastity, you were removing yourself from that institution. The seventh commandment, you shall not steal, was protecting the institution of work for the sake of the family. And when you took the vow of chastity, you were removing yourself from that institution. So that Luther's criticism of monasticism was not simply that it was corrupt, but that it was against the Ten Commandments, and specifically that it was against the three estates, that the Lord has established in his created order three realms in which we live, the family, the state, and the church. And while the Middle Ages had the three estates, those who pray, those who fight, those who work, the problem was that they had pulled all of those apart, so you existed in one or the other. If you were a monk, you removed yourself from fighting and from working. If you were a worker, you removed yourself from fighting and from praying. They were distinct. And Luther said, no, these are God's created orders, and we belong in all of them. So when Luther writes the Catechism, which I think is, it can be understood rightly as his own version of the Augustinian rule. You know, I mean, Benedict had a rule and Augustine had a rule and they all had their rules. If we want a Lutheran rule, that's the Small Catechism. He doesn't establish the 7 hours of prayer. He says, you pray when you wake up, you pray when you go to bed, you pray with your family at every meal. See? And you go to work singing a hymn of the Ten Commandments. He took the hours and he connected it with this life in the family and in the field and in politics and so forth, so that we as Christians are engaged in all of these things. So I don't know if that's even an expounding. I would just recommend that that keep that in mind and go and read the Small Catechism, and it opens up that way. As an evangelical ruler, as a shape to the Christian life, that's really, that's profound. I wish I would have thought of writing the Lutheran option before. Maybe I'll write it next week. And so.
This one is for Dr. Morse. The propaganda pushing transgenderism that is aimed at children is blindsiding many parents. And this is absolutely true. Can you speak about what you have seen in this area and what parents can do about this as far as making other parents aware?
Okay. Normally when I give this talk, I bring a slideshow with me. And the reason I bring the slideshow with me is because I have references on it and I give everybody the PowerPoint. So what I would recommend you do is do go to my Acton University talk on the gender ideology and open up the slideshow. And on there's a couple of slides that have references to people who are dealing with some of this. And one of the most important, there's something called transcritical youth professionals, and I forget the exact name of their website, okay? But these are people who are not Christian, who are not conservative, who are mostly in the helping professions, but they are critical of the whole transgender movement. And so if you go to that website and read what they have to say, you will see experiences of various parents, you know, coming on there and talking about what's now actually called, there's actually a name for it, rapid onset transgenderism. Okay, because the kids go online and they get saturated with this stuff and they convince themselves that they're transgender. So the main thing that I would say in the absence of, in addition to go reading all that stuff, the main thing I would say is do anything you can to slow down whatever process is going on. Say to your child or your friend's child, say, why do you think that? Oh, you think you're not really a boy. Tell me more about how you feel. You know, open that question as much as possible. Slow everything way, way down. Stay away from the doctors. Stay away from the school if you have to, okay? Because there are a lot of people with positions of authority and power who someday are going to be in a lot of legal hot water, who are going to be sued someday because it's really irresponsible now what's going on. But just slow it all down is the main thing I'd say.
Any other thoughts from the other two panelists here?
Doug? Well, and I've encouraged families with similar issues, obviously not to give a child the resources they think they need to make this transition in their lives. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but what I'm saying to parents is be a parent. Maybe we're going to say no really slowly, but we're going to say no. And you just have to keep making that case, and so I can think of a case where, we had a 13-year-old and I just kept saying, this will pass. Keep saying no, keep making faithful resources available to your child in the correct direction.
Right.
And that's the way to do it.
And then did that person, did the situation resolve itself eventually?
It did. Yeah.
See, that's the other thing to be aware of, is that at least 80% of the cases, the gender dysphoria will resolve itself without any intervention at all. So you just need to be aware of that. Do not let yourself be stampeded, and whatever it takes to slow the thing down, that's what you need to do.
Right.
It's sometimes helpful, I think, to be able to put our finger, too, on the ideology that stands behind it. We can name it, and Luther named it enthusiasm. We sometimes call it Gnosticism, but I think that's right, and that is that there is this distinction between creation and between matter and spirit, and that's all that. It's a false distinction, it's a false division, and it's pushed all the way through. And we see it in theology when we talked about it earlier, when the external word is separate from the internal word. That rending apart of those two things is Gnosticism. That when Gnosticism comes to boys and girls, that's what it's going to do. It's going to tear apart the body and the spirit, the body and the whatever my internal invisible life is. And the matter might say one thing, like I'm a boy, and then the spirit says something else, I'm a girl, and then you have to figure out which one is lying to you. But to understand that kind of the rending apart is this fundamental error of Gnosticism. And I think that's sometimes helpful to be able to say that. So you have two voices speaking, your body telling you one thing and your inner life telling you something else. And now you have to say, well, what makes you trust what's going on the inside? I mean, what makes that more trustworthy than what you see on the outside? And it's that Gnostic undermining of all sort of objective truth that puts itself into all of these questions.
I want to endorse what you just said. I mean, Gnosticism is one of the oldest and most persistent Christian heresies, you know, and you can see the whole sexual revolution as an attempt to have technology overwrite the body in some way. You know, there's different ways in which we're attacking the body, that we're dissatisfied with the body, and that we think we have a better idea. And so it's very alluring. You know, we can see how seductive that thing is, that we think we can do it better.
We're listening to our speakers panel Q&A from the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. When we come back, a question for Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse on whether or not the use of eggs in IVF is simply like another form of early adoption. We'll get her response on the other side of the break. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, Missouri is a proud sponsor of Issues, Etc. And if you enjoy the relevant, Christ-centered teachings presented on this program, then you should come and join us at St. Paul's on Sundays at 9 a.m., where you will hear sermons that proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified for our sins, and enjoy in-depth Bible studies to help us grow as disciples. For more information, check us out at stpaullutheranwildwood.org.
Nadia Bowles Weber calls for a sexual reformation in her latest book, Shameless. How does her reformation compare with the truths rediscovered during the 16th century Reformation? I've written a review of Shameless in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button on the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Andrew Abraham details his journey from Catholic priest to Lutheran pastor, the free online Issues Etc. journal. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're listening to our Q&A with our speakers panel from the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, a second round of Q&A with Dr. Scott Murray, Second Vice President of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse of the Ruth Institute, and Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, author of Has American Christianity Failed? Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. That's what you'll find at the one and only 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Chicago. It's an opportunity for you to meet and hear Lutheran Education with Dr. Thomas Korchak, Christian Hope with Pastor Jonathan Fisk, Ross Douthit on Christians in the Public Square, Pastor Hans Feeney on the Lord's Supper, Being Joyfully Lutheran with LCMS President Matt Harrison, Carol Tobias on Planned Parenthood, Matt Walsh on Progressivism, and the Hippocratic Oath with Wesley Smith. Registration is $125 and includes three meals. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org. The 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 7th and 8th at Concordia University in Chicago. The next question is for Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. Some couples with infertility issues believe that using a donated egg is like a form of early adoption. Here's her response.
Okay, well, the reason my husband and I ended up adopting is because we had fertility issues. So I'm very much aware of how painful the infertility experience can be. And one thing that is problematic about this particular thing, which was mentioned, is using a donated egg. or using a donated sperm, what it does, the reason that's different from adoption, is that it puts the mother and father on different footing. So when my husband and I adopted, we were equally the child's parent. Equally not and equally, yes, you know, we were both not the biological parent, we were both the adoptive parents. If you use a donated gamete, what you're really setting up is not an early form of adoption, you're setting up an early form of step-parenthood, of step-familyism, okay? Because one parent is the biological parent and the other one is not. And I have talked to many, I shouldn't say many, but I have talked to and am in contact with a number of donor-conceived persons. And this is a big factor in their life. They call it the Cinderella effect. You know, that they have a wicked stepmother or a wicked stepfather who's the one with the infertility issue. I mean, think about this, okay? I'll just tell you a story of my own goddaughter. I have my goddaughter, Zalana Newman, who writes a website called Anonymous Us. She became a Roman Catholic because when she was going around talking about why donor conception's a bad thing, she worked out that the people who were most likely to be listening and getting it were Catholic, and so she became a Catholic. Anyway, So Alana's story was her mother's first husband was sterile. And so originally, the two of them adopted a child from Korea. 5 years later, they wanted to have another child. For whatever reason, they couldn't adopt. And so Alana's mother decided to do donor conception. Okay, so you know, Alana's father arrived in a little package like that, you know, a little vial of sperm, and that was her father. And so Alana was born and everything, and 8 years later, those parents got divorced. When they got divorced, the father wanted joint custody with the adopted child, but he didn't want custody with Alana. Now, think about that if you're an 8-year-old child, okay? But then also think back to what their 8 years of married life might have been like, okay? This is my child, not your child. No, you can't discipline her because you don't really get it. She's your child, not mine. I'm not interested. You know, and a lot of that stuff, I think there's a kind of primal thing that we have about attachment to our own children. We think it's not there, but it is, right? But it is. And so it had profound effects, I'm sure, on their, you know, I just want you to think through, you know, the person asking this question, just kind of trace through what that's going to look like 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. When, if you have a daughter and you, and your husband is not the daughter's, is not her father, now you're set up for incest that isn't incest. It's not biological incest, but it is. You know, that kind of, nobody sees that coming, but it's coming. You know, I mean, it can be coming, right? So I just think there's much, much more to this question than we're infertile and we want a baby and it's possible, so we're going to do it, you know?
I think there's a case where we Christians didn't understand the technology and we allowed several decades of the technology to advance without having anything to say about it.
Yep.
Because we thought children, and we had the impulse, children are good.
Right.
Bearing children is good, but we never stopped and examined. That's my own pastoral experience with this. Never took the time to actually learn what was actually going on, what was really happening. And so it was easy just to say, wait, you know, now at this late date, when the technology has advanced.
And so widely accepted.
Absolutely.
So widely accepted. This is another thing. I mentioned during my talk that we have, the Ruth Institute has brochures on various people, various of the survivors of the sexual revolution. We have a brochure called Children and Donor Conception. I forget what it's called, exactly what it's called, but you can't miss it. If you go on the website, you'll find it. And inside, there's part of it is a list of the medical risks that are associated with IVF. And I can guarantee you that your friendly neighborhood IVF clinic is not telling the mothers, fully informing them of the risks that their child may have. And then there's another whole part of it that has to do with the psychology of donor conception. So even if you're using the husband's sperm and the mother's egg, The taking it apart and putting it back together and putting it in the body, there are medical risks to the child associated with that. And you just need to be aware of that.
Pastor Wolfmiller, in your presentation, you made a rather fine point on talking about there being no distance between Christ and us in the absolution. And this sparked a question from one of our listeners saying, do you see one of the differences between the declarative absolution, so you have to explain our terms for us, okay, and the indicative proclamatory absolution? This is obviously written by a pastor.
Did you write this question?
As introducing the gap that we would eliminate in this direct connection with Christ you were talking about in the absolution. By the way, I loved your idea about the hands on the head being a sign of certainty that there's no light there.
Well, my answer to that question is yes and no.
Uh-oh. Okay, y'all are giving me a bad impression here.
Wolf Miller, you are going to be a church bureaucrat someday.
Yes.
Dream come true. We want to make a distinction. The declarative, when one of the things, for example, when you go and you visit the Anglican Church or the a Reformed Church, instead of having the absolution, they'll have the declaration of pardon. You know, the difference is basically that the Lutheran pastor said, I give you your sins. It's like when a judge says you are innocent. It's a word that in fact does something. The declaration of pardon is going to be a report. Christ died for you, this sort of thing. Because of the death of Jesus, I can announce to you the pardon and mercy of God. Now, that they might sound very, very close to one another, but there's a world of difference. It's the difference between the judge saying you are innocent and the reporter watching the court case say the judge reported that the person was innocent. I mean, do you see the distance there? Now, most of our sermons are not declarative but indicative. In other words, we're speaking of what Christ has done. The difference is going to be, can you speak the gospel in a declarative way? Do you understand that the preaching of the gospel does have that authority? And if the gospel does that have that authority, then I think that carries over into the indicative preaching of the gospel. So when a Lutheran pastor says Christ has died for you, that's not to say that he's not giving you the absolution, that because we understand that the authority is there in the word. What happens is when a church's theology doesn't allow for a declarative absolution to be spoken, then the indicative preaching of the gospel has taken three steps back and has made the room there. So I don't know if that makes sense what I'm saying. So that, in other words, when a Lutheran pastor says Christ died for you, and an Anglican pastor says Christ died for you, this is the same words, but they have a different import because the Anglican has said that that's all you can say. Whereas we understand from the scriptures, especially from what Jesus says in John chapter 20, whoever sins you forgive, they are forgiven. Because we understand that, then that pushes the gospel, even in the indicative mood, all the way and makes it declarative. Did that make any sense at all?
Made sense to me.
Okay, yeah. That's all I wanted you to know that, Todd, so that's...
Did you write that question?
Let's see. Let me just check our time here. All right, I'm going to give each of our panelists here 30 seconds so we can stay on schedule and we can eat our dinner and then return here for our evening service. Let's see. Well, now I lost my notes.
While you're looking, can I just say something?
Absolutely.
The Catholic absolution in the confessional, let me see if I can remember it word for word.
Okay.
We'll see what we're dealing with here, because I don't know what you're talking about.
I barely know what I'm talking about, so that makes us...
It goes, God the Father of mercies, through the death and resurrection of your Son, has sent the Word among us, has sent the Holy Spirit among us for the forgiveness of sins. Through the ministry of the Church, may God grant you pardon and peace. And I absolve you from your sins in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
What is that? What just happened?
Oh.
I mean, that's
don't look
real
at me.
I feel
feel like that's the real deal from John 20.
That's an absolution.
That's
an absolution.
Right. All right, you got had me worried there.
There's a,
there, all this time, I was thinking I was getting absolution, and I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. The thing you would want to just pay attention to as you look at the distinction between the Lutheran absolution and the Catholic absolution, part of it's going to be found in that phrase, through the ministry of the Church.
Yeah, of course.
That's going to be one. And the other is going to be the role of penance. The role that both sincerity before confession and penance after confession plays.
Okay.
So those are parts of Catholic theology and practice, which Lutherans at best say it's best not to consider those things. And
you guys can pick up this conversation over
at dinner.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So finally, for each one of you, it's only 30 seconds apiece.
Thanks, Jennifer.
I think one of the themes that it's emerged for me, we do not plan these things this way for themes to kind of emerge in the course of the conference, but they do. That Christians live in, we are being reminded daily that we live, as Christ says, in the world, but not of the world. And that's a two-part message. I would like from each of you, in 30 seconds, if possible, what does it mean in the world, but not of the world? And we'll start again with Jennifer.
Well, I look at it this way. Our Lord put me in this particular time and place for a reason. And I don't know what that reason is. So I'm in the world. I'm in this world as it is right now. But I'm not of the world because this is not my final destination. The final destination is to see the Lord face to face and to hopefully give him a good account of the talents that he gave me and the resources that he gave me, and have a good understanding of my vocation. We were talking about vocation early, with the earlier panel, that to do good and to avoid evil, they seem like they're symmetric, but they're not really. To avoid evil, everyone can avoid evil and must avoid doing evil. We can always say, no, I'm not going to do an evil thing, because we can die instead of do the evil thing. Everyone can do that. But to do good, there is an infinite number of goods that we can do, and so we're not obviously not required to do every possible good because you can't, right? So each of us has a vocational calling, and I pray that being in the world but not of the world, that I'm doing my vocation and using to the best of my ability the what God has given me.
Dr. Murray.
Yeah, I mean, we owe the world. God requires us to be responsible to the world. That's what it means to be in it, but not of it. And the way I think about this, I certainly concur with a great deal of what you said, Jennifer, but the way I think about this is that we have better be on our game with the truth right now. Mm-hmm. Why? Because there is an implosion coming. And it will be disastrous. I don't know when. I don't know what the catalyst will be. But if we don't have our game together theologically, and if we haven't passed on the faith, and I mean really passed it on to our children, maybe I'm going to be long gone, I'm praying so, when the implosion comes, then there will be nothing to pass on if we haven't passed on the theology of our small catechism, of Scripture, of our liturgy to our children today. So the responsibility toward the world is not to be the world.
Right.
I mean, this is precisely what it means to be in the world and not of it, is that we have to keep our theology and our practice together to be faithful there, so that when the time comes and the world is a big mess and begins to recognize it, doesn't recognize it right now, that we actually have something with which to resolve the issue of the disaster that will befall.
Pastor Wolfmiller.
I just looked up this text here from Colossians 3, where Paul says, if you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on things of earth. For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. By our baptism and by faith, we are bound up to Jesus, to his death and to his resurrection, and even to his ascension, where he sits at the right hand of the Father and rules and reigns all things for us, for the church, for our benefit. All things work together for those who love God
and are called according to his purpose. That's true. But we do not yet see it. Paul note Hebrews chapter 2, all things are under his feet, but we do not yet see all things under his feet. So we have this reality by faith now, not by sight. Soon our faith will give way to sight, and we will see those things that we already have. Our lives, your lives, are hidden with God in Christ. You already are at the Father's right hand. You already have the fullness of his kingdom. It all belongs to you already. And one day soon we'll see it. And knowing that gives us the courage to come back, engage in this world and in this creation, to receive gifts, to give gifts, bless and to pray, to suffer and to die, to love, all very freely, because we already belong to Jesus, and we are already there with him, seated at the right hand of the Father.
Round of applause for our panelists here in the second wave. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll have Pastor Tom Baker lead us in a Sunday school lesson on Jesus turning water into wine in John chapter 2. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.